So I'm going to jump right in. And I'm going to kind of do this three basic questions, one sort of a panel one type question, two a panel two type question, and a panel three type question. After every question, we'll go to the audience, and we're going to just take as many questions as we can until we run out of time. So the panel one question that I'm going to initially direct to Rob, Bill, and Sabeth is, we heard a good discussion, I thought, in panels one and two about the impact of regulatory guidance on small business lending. And panels one and two also address the issues of collaboration between traditional financial institutions and community development lenders and support services. There was a long discussion of that in panel two. So really the two questions that I'm going to ask the three of you and anybody else who wants to comment on it is, what more, if anything, should federal bank regulators do to ensure that banks are getting correct and consistent messaging on regulatory guidance? And two, what do you think are the most promising potential solutions for improving the coordination and handoffs between traditional financial institutions and community development lenders and TA providers? So I don't know. Do you want to start that, Rob?
Thanks, Joseph. Good afternoon. Great to be here today. And you did say we could go off script now since it's kind of
as
the
long
end
as
of the
it's
afternoon.
Short. Yeah.
I flew up here from my hometown, Miami, where I was the last 10 days, not to stir it up, but it was a good week to be in Miami last week. I got to tell you, I looked at the data panel and the topic, and I said, goodness, you know, after lunch, middle of the afternoon, and I thought the panel was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think we covered a lot of provocative things, and you know, there's this raging debate about demand and creditworthiness and everything. Let me just tell you first off, I am responsible for about 275,000 mostly small business clients at Bank of America, and we are trying to make every good loan we can. It's been said many times today. You know, it's the lifeblood. It's the ticket to the dance for a lot of other stuff that makes us a lot of money. And we have second look programs. We have even third look programs that I know because I'm sometimes the third look. And I'm looking at Kathy So over there, but raise your hand, Kathy. She is responsible for small business credit, and we are trying to make good loans. I want to recognize Marilyn Landis. Did I get the – raise your hand, Marilyn, because she had the courage to ask a really good question at the end, I believe, of the first group. And it was something to the effect of how do you reconcile the you know, lending to an established client who's maybe had a lot of good years but has had a couple of really tough years. And from a regulatory standpoint, I mean, there's a conflict there. And I would agree with a number of the comments made that every situation is different, and we're rolling up our sleeves and trying to make it work. From a practical standpoint, I would tell you, though, it can be problematic lending new dollars into a situation where we don't have recent historical cash flow. So I don't know if anybody wants to come back to that later, but thank you for asking the question. It does present a problem because we want to make good loans. Some questions about have underwriting standards changed. I would tell you that I think that they have tightened somewhat over the last 2 years, but I'd also suggest that they are back to where they were before we saw the, you know, kind of the craziness leading up to the recession. In many cases, it's feeling different for clients now as well because we're asking for financial statements in some cases where we haven't asked for them in a number of years. And when we get the financial statements, that is leading to a lot of questions. So it's feeling different from a client's perspective. We are less reliant on credit scores. That came up earlier. We do believe that they are more of a lagging indicator. So looking at traditional cash flow for repayment alone is very important. I'll get to your question, and then I'll shut up. We have had a lot of discussions with regulators lately, and there's been heightened scrutiny, blinding flash of the obvious, right? It's appropriate. We have had some challenges, particularly in our small business portfolio, so it is appropriate. And I can tell you that, and I'm told that we have had more discussions with regulators than in any time in maybe ever, but certainly in recent memory. We believe it has been productive. Regulators have reached out to us several times over the last few months wanting to brainstorm about how we can fix this credit issue. So a general recommendation would be to continue to have that dialogue. We think it's productive.
And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. So one sort of the blinding obvious given the name of this panel, but this panel is going to be about pulling together a list of specific next steps. Actually, I've been taking notes throughout the conference and have a many pages of them. But as each panelist is talking, I appreciate doing what Rob just did, which is specific suggestions and particularly who. So, Bill, do you want to take a crack at both of those questions or anything that you heard in panel one in particular?
Sure. I think to hear the lenders on the first panel, you know, you'd wonder if there's a credit gap. And I think, you know, clearly that was not the intent, but credit unions have millions of members. CDFIs are seeing demand greater than we've ever seen. Certainly our demand has increased each year since the recession and continues to be stronger than we can respond to with the liquidity and resources that we have. It's clear that there's mixed messages. I'm putting on my credit union hat. There's clear mixed messages with regard to regulatory expectations and guidance. I think some lenders use it as a crutch, quite frankly, to not lend and in areas where they don't have the experience to lend. Many lenders in our region don't have aren't very concerned about CRA. I think it varies from region to region across the country, but CRA doesn't have the teeth in some areas, and lenders aren't held as accountable. I think it would be helpful to see more clear documentation of the guidance with examples. That's disseminated to lenders that we can use and have discussion around and has clear examples, and we can provide input and get more clear about what's expected by the regulators, and perhaps a help center where we can pick up the phone and ask questions and clarification. And also, I think some of us would not mind having some sort of whistleblower protections if there's disagreement with our examiners. If we don't feel like guidance is being followed as clearly as it should be and we have different interpretations, then it's not easy to pick up the phone and go over the head of your examiners. You're a little reluctant to do that. You know, and you want to maintain a good, positive relationship with your examiner, but for example, credit unions, examiners were issued guidance with regard to low-income community development credit unions to look at the unique kind of capital structures that we have, to look at the unique borrowers that we serve, and to take that in consideration when undertaking our exams. And I've heard some credit unions say that when they mentioned that to the examiners, they never saw it. And that's surprising because the chairman of NCUA had a teleconference with all examiners to be very clear, but I think some of the regulators are in a CYA mode, and that trickles down and has a significant impact on lenders' comfort and ability to extend business credit.
Great. So I'm going to actually circle back in a second on the question about coordination between the traditional lenders and the CDFI lenders, but I really want to let Sabeth have a chance to talk about some of the comments that Bill had and anything else you heard this morning about, you know, the response to concerns about regulatory guidance and maybe even share with folks some of the things we've been doing and, you know, and respond to Bill's suggestions about, you know, maybe an appeals process or help center or more examples.
Yeah. So we have heard issues about bankers saying that examiners are being overzealous. We've heard from borrowers saying banks themselves are being too conservative. And so this issue about supply-demand has been coming up over and over again. And I think it's really a mixture of a combination of factors, both supply and demand. And actually, on this issue about examiners being overzealous, we have repeatedly told banks across the country that if you have come across a case where examiners are unfairly implementing the guidance, give us a call. I've given them my number personally and their other numbers. I have yet to receive one single call. And this has been going on for over months now. From time to time, I do get a call from, let's say, a banker about, you know, a particular case. And then when we delve into the details, we find that the examiner was on the right because there were significant credit issues. So blanket statements were made such as the borrower has plenty of net worth, yet they're not getting a loan. And so then you delve into when was the last time an appraisal was made on the borrower's net worth, and it turned out it was several years ago, and now it's a completely different story. So I would say that we have encouraged institutions to call us in Washington, and there's also a process in place in the reserve banks to bubble up issues if they think that they're being treated unfairly. On the other side, to ensure that examiners are interpreting the guidance consistently with what we intended it to be, we have conducted numerous training across the country, as well as reach-out efforts, ask the Fed, which our Julie Stackhouse has innovated in St. Louis and has done incredibly well. And so we continue to do that, and we're very committed to making sure our message is getting out there in a consistent fashion. And I do want to also thank Rob Hilson and his team, along with a few other banks that we've consulted with in developing some of the guidance in making sure the right message about credit availability and lending is getting out to is out there. We try not to operate in a silo here in Washington. We try to get ideas from the industry, and all of you have been very helpful.
All right. And just as a documentation point, the in your folders, the capstone summary document does have footnoted in it a location as to where you can find the guidance that Sabeth is referring to, both with respect to small business as well as commercial real estate. So you can find that there. I think what we're going to do is we're going to give the audience a chance to weigh in on just some of these panel one questions, either the regulatory question as well as the coordination question, and then I'm also going to let our other panelists weigh in. But are there any questions from the audience? We wore you out. Oh, here we go. Okay. There's one in the middle, if we can get a microphone. Wait, hold on a second.
During the task force in San Francisco that I participated in, it came up very loud and clear, and the two CDFIs, feel free to weigh in on this too, that we needed to give more value in during the CRA examination to the bank investments, the EQ2 type of hybrid investments, primarily because we're seeing a retrenchment in California on some of these investments. And we're really concerned about it because these have been very flexible, patient capital in our communities. So that was one. We'd like to see increased value for that. And then for the risk mitigators, when a bank gives a grant to technical assistance, we heard a lot about technical assistance today, we would like to see folks like Bank of America that do a lot of grant making for technical assistance be able to get a higher value on their investment test than they currently do now. We think, and there was agreement, my colleagues are nodding, that this would go really far to address the issues that Alicia mentioned earlier today.
Yeah, and just as I think it was mentioned briefly on panel two, I think Don Graves might have mentioned it, but we're in the process of going out on the road and doing a series of four interagency CRA hearings where we're going to be addressing these very types of issues. So there's going to be even more opportunity for us to gather some of these particular points. But so does anyone respond to either of those or on that particular point?
I think they're great suggestions.
Okay. Another question? Yes, right here in the middle.
Directly responding to Claudia, I'm Andrea Levere from the Corporation for Enterprise Development. It's the whole issue, which was barely raised today, which is a huge issue when it comes to small business access to credit, but also access to financing, of access to good financial products and services. Mm-hmm. So that small piece is how do we get that recognized, which we've been talking about, as you know, for over a decade in CRA, because the whole implication of using predatory lenders and check cashers and all those other things without getting access to high-quality financial products and services has an enormous issue, if we were to say, in the whole spectrum of small business finance. You know, access to credit is a small piece relative to this. Mm-hmm. The other piece, though, I think, which also is, I'm listening to this conversation, and it is this, almost the same conversation in terms of small business credit that I heard in 1983 when I started doing SBA 504 lending. And what hasn't been reflected, and maybe we'll get to this at the end, is the need for profound innovation in all aspects of how we deliver business development services and how we connect to financial products and services and how we link small businesses to the tax system so they get much better tax advice, and how we think about connecting CDFIs to a much more efficient capital market to get capital. So there's a whole set of issues around innovation and mm-hmm. how we go forward, which I think must be on this agenda, because otherwise we're having the same conversation where we have the conversation about small businesses and startups not getting access to credit, when that's the wrong question, because it's all about, you know, the risk return analysis we learned in business school. And startup capital is the highest risk kind of capital, and a financial institution or a bank is not going to provide it. And so we need to figure out what's the realistic response. I know that wasn't quite what you wanted, Joe.
No, that's great.
Waiting all day say that.
Can I just add that I think that, to your point, it's going to be even more important that there's a comprehensive solution, because it's been said many times today, home equity doesn't exist like it did 5 years ago, and access to, you know, credit cards, the startup. My friends don't have as much money as they had 3 years ago. So, I mean, it's points well made.
Does anyone else want to address that?
But, I think it's a critical point. These gaps, you said these conversations were the same ones we've had for decades now. I mean, these gaps have always existed, particularly in the space that CDFIs work. You talk about the collateral, declining collateral values. We'll talk about no collateral values, credit challenges, resource constraint. Well, the banks are resource constrained. Imagine what CDFIs experience. CDFI's DNA has always been about lending in underserved, distressed, imperfect circumstances. And since the transition of the new administration, and since then, we've been working closely to try to encourage and the increased profile and resources availability to CDFIs to be a part of the financial mainstream, financial continuum in this country, not just an afterthought, not when it's a CRA consideration at play, but when you look at where the hardest hit areas or where the areas of highest need, CDFIs have played a critical role in addressing those financing gaps, whether it's after 9/11, lending to nonprofits, lending to small entrepreneurs, to micro businesses, after Katrina on the Gulf Coast, now with BP dealing with the fishermen and all the challenges they're experiencing. Banks weren't lending in those areas before these crises in many cases, and they're going to be the last to lend as the economy starts to go back. So it's critical that if we're going to include everyone in economic recovery, the CDFIs are better positioned and better resource, both with capital and liquidity, but also to address the technical assistance needs that not just helps our borrowers become successful and viable, but also facilitates the relationships that we have with many banks. I mean, this is a lending continuum. We are part of that continuum, but we don't have full access to the range of programs that banks have access to, 7A loans. Regulated institutions do, loan funds don't. TARP funds, TARP's over, but CDFI loan funds still need liquidity to address their needs. So there's a need to continue these conversations, and I think this is an important part of that. But we need to move past the conversations and really get resources in the hands of these institutions so that we can help close the gaps that
right.
exist.
And in fact, Beth, do you want to just...
Yeah, and just to help with the innovation, and we've talked about this all day, is information and the lack of information and transparency. And the way to enhance innovation is and liquidity is to provide more information. And that's what's lacking, enough data. We've talked about improving data infrastructure, and I think one of the first areas we should focus on in order to help enhance innovation is to get more data and transparency in that area. And if you look at how different products in the financial markets developed over time, you'll note that the transparency in those markets was the first thing that developed, and that came with data, lots of data, and convergence in the price discovery between the bidders and the askers. And right now, there is a lot of information CDFIs have, but there's a lot of information other investors don't have. And the way to bridge the gap is to increase the transparency between the two markets.
Right. That's actually a great segue into our next point. And I know there's a lot of people raising their hands, and I'm going to give you a chance in 1 second. But just to make the segue, because the next question is really that I'm going to ask Ginger, Dan, and Bill, and any others to address, really addresses some of the panel two questions that we had related to CDFIs, the SBA programs, and getting capital into some of these industries. And so the question is, and I'm going to be very specific to solutions here, in your view, what are the top 1 to 2 next steps that should be taken, and by whom, to improve the effective utilization of either SBA, CDFI fund, or other federal programs, whether they be USDA, in the case, Bill, you were mentioning to me the other day about some of the rural stuff. But what do you think are the top couple things? We heard a lot of suggestions in panel two, but I'd love you to, you know, just sort of highlight that. And the second question really deals with capital, and that's, what are the top 1 to 2 next steps that should be taken, and by whom, to ensure that CDFIs and other community development providers have adequate capital to meet small business loan demand? So, Ginger or Dan, since you haven't had a chance to speak, do you want to start off, and then we can kind of go from there?
If I could comment about the issue about access to credit generally, I mean, we've heard from bankers who say there's no credit gap, we're ready to make loans, and then we've heard from others who say that our customers have not been able to get loans. It's almost as if you have, you know, two blind people feeling the elephant, and they're feeling different parts of that elephant, you know, in the sense that they're probably, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, in the sense it depends on where you sit. And I think if you're in the domestic emerging markets, if you're a woman, minority-owned businesses in particular, where we have, in fact, seen a decline in access to capital and continue to see a decline in access to capital, that there continue to be challenges. If you're an older, well-financed, or you have a robust cash flow, getting access to capital is certainly less of an issue. I think that small businesses generally have much fewer options in terms of getting access to capital than large businesses. You know, small businesses cannot issue corporate debt. They can't issue bonds. They exploring things like factoring, et cetera, is an expensive proposition. So when you look at the range of small business products that are available to them, it's certainly not as robust a range of financial products. And I think that is part of the problem. I think the other issue that was talked about earlier was this issue of declining collateral. There is, in fact, that. But I think there's also another issue, and that impacts startups. And we are moving to a knowledge-based economy. We have a lot of companies, startup companies, that are, you know, they're developing software. Okay, they don't have a building. They don't have inventory. And we don't have sort of standardized methodologies for valuing knowledge and intangible assets. And I submit that as we go forward, I think this is going to become a greater issue. You know, we now have virtual companies. You know, my son works for a company. I'm not even sure where it's located anymore. You know, but it's all done on the Internet, right? I mean, there's clearly no office. There's barely a laptop that the company pays for. And so, I think one of these issues, when we talk about collateral, I think going forward, we also need to think about what type of collateral are we talking about. And I haven't heard anybody address this issue of intangible assets, because that is critical for startup companies.
Great. And then just Dan, if you could key off of the Bill Bynum's point about the need for, or whether it be helpful to have CDFIs being more involved in the SBA guarantee programs. I know you're a CDFI that is that. If you could just describe that process and just provide your perspective.
I just want to first comment in terms of the banker's comment on the earlier panel. Many of the CDFI CEOs came up to me and said, Dan, you got to say something about that. Because one of the things that happened in CDFIs is we've always lent to our traditional markets, which are obviously low-wealth communities, people of color, and women. But a lot of the clients that were formerly bankable came to us. And so we had to deal with a situation where you had a client that was profitable 10 years in a row, and last year they were not. All of a sudden we have to deal with that situation, meaning a bankable client and our clients. And so we were sort of squeezed in the middle of having to finance those businesses. And then at the same time, we had a liquidity issue, which is we had much more demand than we were used to, and then our investors got much tighter. So that was sort of the issue that was happening with us. And just one more comment about the earlier discussion on regulation. While CDFIs are not necessarily regulated, our investors really got active in the last year, and they asked, I would say, their due diligence went up tenfold. And so my controller was 50% of their time. I mean, you know Ron, right? 50% of my controller's time last year, over the past year, was talking to our investors. Maybe it was 5-10% in the past. So it really focused us on around investors, and it felt like regulation. And so it did have an effect of tighten up our
isn't it also the truth? I mean, Mark Pinsky actually corrected me on this when I was talking the other day, is that to be part of the SBA program, right, yeah, you're regulated at the state level.
And I'm going to go to that. Yeah. So in terms of the 7A, I think there's probably only a dozen CDFIs in the country, and you can correct me with that number, that actually have the 7A program. And that's an unfortunate situation because it took us, Community First Fund, 3 years to get the program, we got it in 2007. And one of the major things is that you have to be regulated. Well, CDFIs, by our nature, are not regulated. So the unfortunate thing is it doesn't take into accountability your track record. So whether you have a CARS rating that OFN Mark has really worked on, the CDFI assessment rating system, your track record doesn't matter. So even if you have a great rating, you can't get the 7A program. So we did it the hard way. I don't think other CDFIs need to be in the position to get the 7A program. We've done, we worked on that program prior to the recession. And fortunately for us, over the last year, we've been able to lend millions of dollars in that program. It only represents about 20% of our loans. So quite frankly, the bank standards and the SBA standards are much higher than our standard. In other words, we're doing 80% of our lending outside of that. So it's part of the solution. It's not the solution. There's a number of other things that I would say if I have a moment.
Let's do this. Bill Bonham, do you want to just add any other point related to this question of CDFI capital, access to capital?
Well, just that we went in through the back door as well to get a SBA, become an SBA 7A lender before we started a credit union. CDFIs are not formally regulated, but we do undergo a great bit of scrutiny by our investors, bank investors, foundation investors, those that are CDFI certified, submit regular reports. So there are proxies to, I think, get a comfort level with the work that CDFIs do and to make the 7A program available to them, particularly if we're looking at the need for the continued shrinking in access capital for startups. You know, 7A has been one of our primary tools to make loans for startups, as well as to women and minority businesses. Also think it's important to not leave off the table the gap that exists in rural areas. The Bank of America's Chase Goldman's don't have an office in Alligator, Mississippi, or done very little lending in the Lower Ninth Ward and now in Plaquemines Parish. And so how do we bring those resources to bear? And I think one of the important pieces of the puzzle, in addition to increased CRA accountability, is to use intermediaries such as national intermediaries like OFN and Calvert and this Venture Capital Association, as well as regional intermediaries, such as organizations like ours. There are CDFIs that work with other nonprofits that can be a conduit to bringing capital into these underserved areas, which, be honest, large mega banks are not going to reach very effectively in our lifetime.
Actually, with that as a segue, I don't know if either somebody from OFN, Mark, or somebody from Calvert, but can you just say a word about the intermediary role that you guys are playing in this new program that you have?
Shari, are you here? I don't know if Shari Barenbach's still here.
Let Mark have the first, and then we'll let Wayne. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, Wayne's here. You want to go ahead, Wayne? Okay. I'm Mark Pinsky with Opportunity Finance Network, and I'll describe that. I want to make a couple comments about sort of some underlying thoughts. It's been a great day. Great event. Thank you to all the panelists and speakers. So you want to talk about the Communities at Work Fund. We created, with Calvert Foundation and Citi, we created a $200 million fund called the Communities at Work Fund that was created through the use of a special purpose vehicle, famous word, right? We all like to talk about that. But that it's a vehicle that's intended to lend to nonprofit and for-profit businesses on a national scale through CDFIs. It was created with a little bit of capital from Calvert Foundation and from OFN, but a large investment from Citi. And what I really, if I can just go off from there, one of the things to pick up on Bill's point just then, one of the things that's really interesting, we talked about Goldman, but also Bank of America, Wachovia Wells, Citi, JP Morgan Chase. You put them together in the last year, they've committed more than $1 billion to CDFIs to lend to small businesses, right? And there's something behind that. That's not a nice thing to do. That's a necessary thing to do, it seems to me. And it seems to me that there's a recognition, to Bill's point, that in order to move capital to support small businesses, which we all recognize a need to do, that there's a real need to use intermediaries. So I'm trying to be brief. One other comment I sort of want to make, and then Wayne, I'll turn it over to you. It just seems to me that there's a question underlying everything we've been talking about today, which is whether what's happened in the economy in the last few years, and it goes a little bit to Andrea's comment about what things look like in 1983, 84, right, is are we just seeing sort of a little, is this a little blip, or is this a seismic shift in some way? And is it going to stay or not? Because the way you think about policy solutions and the way you think about the relationship between, seems to me, between mainstream financial institutions and CDFIs and CDFIs in their markets, both of them in their markets, has a lot to do with whether you think this is something that we're going to sort of do for a little while, we'll put a little money into CDFIs, and then we'll go back to the way it was before, or whether you think that there's a longer shift. I tend to think it's the latter, and I think that there's a lot of innovation, to Andrea's point, there's a lot of innovation now in thinking about how do you make capital flow in a prudent way, whether it's through CDFIs or other means, and how do you bundle that, as Andrea was saying, with other financial products and services and asset building strategies and things like that. I think that's changing for good, or for good meaning 10, 15 years, if right. That's good. I think we have to think about that. So when you think about the SBA 7A 504, you think about, Bill talked about some of the Treasury programs we've been working with for loan funds. I think the question is there a policy imperative, because we know this is going to change for good. So.
Right. And I want to make sure that we have a chance for multiple audience comments related to this panel, two kinds of issues, both the SBA, the rural lending stuff with USDA and CDFI. I know that you had a question here. If I could just call on you, the woman in the
future. Just make a comment about the rural.
Yeah, sure. Ginger,
just
go
quickly.
Ahead.
People may not know that the SBA and USDA recently signed a memorandum of understanding to work together on their loan programs. In particular, there's two elements or three elements. One is to build on each other's leverage, each other's network of lending programs and services. Two, they're beginning a process to look at their whole forms and try to see if they can harmonize that a little bit more, because we've heard from rural banks that, you know, you have the USDA products and you have the SBA products, and there's a way to bring those together to more closely align with each other that would make it an easier time for them. And I think the third component is to provide the type of, again, the training for the USDA network, which doesn't do the volume that SBA does. So I think that's important to see.
Great. That's helpful. Go ahead and provide. I know you've been waiting for a long time.
No. I'm Penelope Douglas from Pacific Community Ventures. And this was a question earlier. It may turn into more of a comment, but I'll try to be really brief. But one of the observations that I had earlier today was that we were talking still in silos. And I think as the days progressed, we've gotten a little away from that. But one of the things that I think everyone around the room has in common, for sure, is each of us is deeply in a practice of some kind. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have invited us here if you didn't view us as the experienced players. Mm-hmm. And I hear at least three business models that are being talked about. We avoid certain words, like we don't say the non-bankable, we don't say the almost bankable, but we all have successful business models that satisfy a particular part of a continuum that if anything today really requires a very comprehensive, non-siloed set of solutions for. So to the extent that it's possible to really try to avoid having too many goals, but to really try to pick those top priority one or two goals that we think we can accomplish, and then really try to look to those who are willing to be accountable to standing up for a good business model that we think will produce the result and accountable for that result. I honestly think, you know, some of those objectives will be better met.
Yeah.
And the one theme that's been overarching across the entire day, which I want to go back to because I actually think it meets the business need of each of these business models and also can be very innovative, is in this area of advisory services or mm-hmm. technical assistance. I prefer to call it advisory services. And it absolutely has to meet the needs both pre- and post-financing, whether it's debt or equity investment of these small companies. But I can't think of a single one of our banking partners or a single one of my CDFI colleagues or today any one of my micro-lending colleagues who doesn't now fully embrace that advisory services are a supporting structure
right.
to the underserved community in the United States.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. I know the gentleman a couple down from you who had his hand up, he's been eager to speak, and then we're going to go to our third question.
I'll be real quick, 90 seconds. Equity. Now, I'm a banker. I work with one of the largest banks in the country, BB&T. But what I don't hear a lot of discussion about is equity, and I hope that becomes a discussion or a follow-up point, primarily because there's compression of real estate values. We're cash flow lenders. We're always looking at that 1.2, 1.25 ratio. But with the compression of real estate values, the fact that people don't have secondary collateral, there needs to be some form of shoring up these businesses, be they startups, restarts, and other places like that. So my question would be particularly to Ms. Liu has the administration considered ways to invest in these businesses or make funds available through CDFIs or community development venture capital funds or through the SBIC program, and one that Wayne is talking about, emerging enterprise. I mean, just equity that helps us make deals and have a secondary source of repayment or some mitigation because of the collateral shortages right now.
That's a great question. Ginger, do you want to take that? Maybe Bill Bynum?
There's really two programs that are under consideration. One is under the House Small Business Jobs Bill, there was a provision to establish a SEED, SBIC program, and that passed the House. It's now under consideration on the Senate side. Then there is, in fact, the state credit capital program, which, if you look at the language that's been proposed, is extremely flexible. It could be used for a revolving loan fund. It can be used for a regular, you know, lending program by the state. It can also be used as an equity investment tool. It can also be used as a loss loan reserve fund. So there are a variety of iterations that can be associated with that particular program.
Okay, Bill, did you want to make any comment just on the issue of venture capital or just equity? Are you good?
No, I'm fine. I think one point, again, equity, about equity.
Yeah.
In that I know there's been some challenges over the years to how effective SBA and new markets have been in reaching communities of highest need and CDFIs that are operated by minorities. We heard comments earlier about the Latino population. I think minority-led SBICs, I think, are important as well. And so as these programs roll out, I think it's critical to look at where those gaps are that may not be adequately addressed, have not been adequately addressed historically.
Okay, good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into my third panel, and we may not even take the full 15 minutes for it because I want to have a catch-all for anyone to just have sort of absolute things that we need to do as next steps. But really what I want to do is address some of the panel three discussion, and I'm going to ask Ginger and Sabeth to help lead this discussion. But really, quite simply, based on the whole data conversation, what do you think are the key one to two next steps that can be taken and by whom to help close data and research gaps?
This issue was something that we confronted early on in the administration when we came in and found outdated data, and it was extremely frustrating to think about how we formulate policies when it wasn't really driven data or based upon data that was timely. And so I think having the FDIC call reports modified so that they are done on a quarterly basis would be really critical. I think the other is to segment the loan reports. So right now it's being done on under $1 million or less, under $1 million, but really to segment that further so we start getting data on loans that are $100,000 or less, $100,000 to $250,000, $250,000 and $1 million, because that starts giving you information about the smaller borrowers and the banks that are doing those types of transactions and where they're happening. I think another thing is to also go up the value chain a little bit and collect data on loans approximately $3 million and up to $4 million. As you know, the president has called for increasing SBA loan sizes up to $5 million. The current $2 million limit was implemented back in the late 1980s and has never been adjusted even for inflation. Mm-hmm. So clearly we're talking about a loan amount that needs to be looked at in more modern times.
Okay. So Beth, any comments on this one?
I agree with Ginger. Now, on the call report, we've already started collecting quarterly information on the same exact information we've been collecting on an annual basis on small business loans or small loans. We're now collecting on a quarterly basis. I do think it's time to get more robust data on in this sector. We have for some time getting a lot of information on large loans. We call it the large syndicated loan market, or SNCs. That's what regulators call it. And in that market, we can slice and dice information by borrower, industry type, probability of default, type of facility, and so forth. So I think we should be migrating towards that direction, given the importance small business has in the economy. And, you know, burden I buy to a certain extent. But look, we got we know when LeBron James called the media to announce where he's going to end up, we know in one day that 10 million viewers, tuned in. So if we can do that in one day, why can't we collect data in such a important
sector? So maybe 10 million people will actually read our call reports. All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm actually going to open this wide open. So questions don't have to be on specifically on these panel three type things, but they can be. But we essentially will take audience questions till about 5 minutes after, and then I'm going to give the panelists 10 minutes to go through and make any final points, and then at 5:15, Governor Duke will make some remarks. So,
Joseph, can I throw one point out about the data? Currently, the cutoff for mandated reporting is $1 billion and this really limits what we know about small business lending in rural areas, because most of the lending is done by small community banks or CDFIs or credit unions, and so we don't have a lot of data around what's going on in rural areas. And so to be a little at risk of getting thrown at, maybe consider decreasing the asset size of banks that are required to report small business lending, or either conduct a study to try to quantify what the gap is, what information we need in rural areas is something we should take a look
at. That's good. And actually, in the spirit of Bill's last comment, for the next few questions or comments, if you can make it specific to a solution that you think that we should consider as we're looking at next steps. I know you've had your hand up, so right there at the front row. Yeah.
Well, let me respond this way. In Los Angeles, you're starting to see a phenomenon of disillusionment. You know, we talk about the unemployed stop looking for jobs, which begins to complicate the unemployment rate. Do you believe we're starting to see the same thing with small business? Small businesses disillusioned, not looking for capital. Even businesses who have the ability to borrow simply getting tired of being told no. And what would the banks, what would the federal government, what would the CDFIs do to begin to be able to get past that perception?
Anyone want to take that one?
I think Zoltan and on the previous panel mentioned something about, you know, first of all, I think you're asking. One of the assumptions is, you know, you're asking how long will this recovery process take? And if you believe that it's going to take more than, you know, the remainder of this year and perhaps even part of next year, then the question is there in fact a role for the federal government? And, you know, the president has proposed that the SBA loan guarantees, the 90% guarantees and the fee waivers, be extended through 2010, and it's my understanding that the Senate Small Business Jobs Bill actually proposes that for a longer period of time. But I think it goes to this broader question of how can we continue to incentivize banks to step up to make the types of loans to businesses that are, I would say, on the margins, who are doing okay and making it and just need a little bit of capital to either expand their inventory or, fulfill some orders. And I think the challenge is providing some long-term steady responses. I mean, this short-term reauthorization of a 90% guarantee and it's extended for 30 days or 60 days, it's hard not only for the banks to do business, it's hard for SBA to do that type of business. And it's hard for small businesses to decide whether or not they should, get into the market and apply for a loan. So something with a longer tail, I think, is really important.
Okay. I know, Dan LaTondra, you had your hand up, so you want to go ahead?
Thank you. Dan LaTondra, CDFI Lending and Investing at Bank of America. My question is for Bill and for Dan. When Joe started the panel, he asked you to comment on the one or two things that the government can end up doing, particularly the federal government can do to make it easier for you to finance small businesses. Can I ask, at the risk of publicly raising expectations, what would be the one or two things that financial institutions can or should be doing to help CDFIs further advance lending to small businesses? Perhaps, is it grant support, as Penelope said, for technical assistance, loan loss reserve? Is it loan capital that we really need right now? Is it referrals of small business candidates or some or something else in that category?
The first that I would say, Dan, is
that's what they call a slow pitch, right?
Right down the middle.
Were you the plant that I talked about, Dan? I think the first is the investor, and what I talked about earlier, the regulation, like from our investors, including bankers. And I'll keep harping on the CDFI rating system, and I really think that I'd like to see more bankers really using that. And really putting more faith on that, because it's very obvious to me that banks re-underwrite, even though CARS reports very extensive. So I think just that amount of effort using that rating even more than ever, I think, would be helpful.
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, you were one of the first.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Bank of America.
No, and I'm just saying that's a good model, yeah, that, using CARS ratings to sort of guide your underwriting. So that's good. Okay, continue. I'm sorry.
And then the second part is what someone said earlier was the EQ2s. That's the equity-like investments, which I know that Bank of America does, or at least PRIs. And I think more of that, because that's one of the things that hinders our growth, is the amount of debt that we can take on. So to the extent that we can get more equity, we can grow our funds and then meet those demands that we're trying to do.
Okay. Next. I think you in the back. Frank, do you want to say something?
A couple of things. I want to go back to what Mark Pinsky raised, and that is this a seismic shift that we're seeing here in terms of how capital goes to small business, or is it a blip? And I think it's too early to say, but I think it is important to recognize that before the crash, there were huge amounts of capital pursuing loans. So too much capital pursuing loans. Now there's too little. So the demand-supply issue that we talked about earlier, I think maybe to a certain extent, there has to be some disequilibrium, and we need more capital in the system to start funding these loans again. And I think the capital in the system that is gone is capital that was through securitization and secondary market operations. And that capital has been pretty much eliminated. And that was a huge percentage, more capital flowing into lending than coming from conventional bank lending. That capital is gone. And what will restart that is the growth of basically federally supported credit enhancements. So liquidity provisions that will start putting more liquidity into systems, whether it be CDFIs or the general business lending system. And I know this whole marketplace, just the words securitization and ratings and so forth are poisonous to many people. But that's something I'm actually surprised was never raised today in this discussion. The fact that huge arm of capital, the capital markets connection to small business lending, has really been broken, with the exception of the small business, the 7A secondary market, which is coming back, and a few other areas that are coming back. So I'm curious about the panel and if anyone sees it this way or if I'm just living in the past and this really is never going to come back again.
I think you raise an excellent point. I may not have the statistic exactly right, but at the height of, you know, the boom, so let's say sometime in early 2007, the fuel, if you will, for the economy, about 30% of it was traditional bank debt, and the other 70% was that other stuff you talked about. And a lot of that has gone away, and some of it has come back, but it hasn't come close to coming back.
Okay. What I'm going to do now is, because I've been so tough on my former moderators, that I want to be equally tough on myself. We have a hard stop at 5:15 when Governor Duke is going to be starting. So what I'd like to do is give each of our panelists, and we're just going to go down the row, a couple minutes, 10 minutes total, to basically provide any final closing remarks. And really, sort of quote Kim Zuli the way she did it, is if you could just mention maybe the one thing, or if you have time, the two things that you think we should do. Whether if they've been said, great. If they haven't been said, even better. But Rob, do you want to start?
4 points in less than 2 minutes.
Sure.
We fully support Administrator Mills' recommendations to enhance, expand SBA lending. And to include, we are in favor of expanding CDFI access to SBA programs. We're asking CDFIs to take more risk. We think there ought to be an opportunity for them to participate more fully in SBA programs. We're excited. Next month, we will begin work. We've been talking with the SBA since January, and we will launch a program. We'll be one of the first, or maybe the first, and we expect many others to follow, where we will be buying SBA paper, taking it from community banks that will free up capital for them, packaging it, and selling it to investors. We think that will help, and we are certainly committed to buying more from small businesses. You heard a lot today about revenue is a big challenge for small businesses, and we think it's very important for us to increase our commitment to buy from small businesses, and would hope others follow. Thank you.
First, I'd like to start by just saying how much I appreciate the fact that these conversations were held in a broad geography. It's not typical for hearings to be held in Little Rock and Atlanta and Baton Rouge. So to have Southern input and rural input has been really important, and I hope that continues. Chairman Bernanke started out this morning telling us to be wary of a one-size-fits-all solutions, and I think that that's really important. There are nuanced differences in what different parts of the country are experiencing in terms of access to credit. And certainly the demands that CDFIs have seen has indicated that there are still significant credit needs and credit gaps. The CDFI Advisory Board made some recommendations that have been slowly but certainly being implemented about increasing liquidity for CDFIs, increasing capacity of CDFIs. I think that it's important to continue to build on those. The fund has done an incredible job of putting money out quickly, but the fund is oversubscribed, seriously oversubscribed. Probably, I don't have the exact numbers, but many times more demand for the core funding programs as well as for new markets than there is funding availability. And so I think it's really important to continue to push to get resources to CDFIs and make them a more formal part of the financial continuum, and to make CDFIs give them access to the range of credit enhancements, capital programs that are available throughout the federal government, not just SBA, but USDA has a great menu of programs that could be very helpful, as well as, you know, we're not talking about housing, but HUD, Energy, Interior has resources as well. But CDFIs are too often not on the front burner. I think the Director Gambrell has done a great job of pulling together different agencies and starting conversations. SBA has responded. USDA is starting to respond. I think the momentum needs to continue and integrate CDFIs more into the broad resources that the federal government has at their disposal.
Okay, Dan?
And I have to agree with Mark Pinsky. I think CDFIs are The fact that we're here well represented in all panels, that we are part of the mainstream discussion. And I want to thank Joseph for that, bringing City of Fires front and center. Some of the things that we have not talked about was sort of unrelated to, seems like it's unrelated to business, but that's the Federal Home Loan Bank system. And I'll just give you a quick backdrop. CDFIs need to take advantage of government-guaranteed rates. That is a sort of investments at a very low cost in the bond market. And Congress quietly passed about a year or so the ability for CDFIs to borrow from the Federal Home Loan Banks for any purpose, including housing and business. And the unfortunate situation is the Federal Home Loan Banks have not, while we can become members, have not made it easy for us to borrow. They want us to put up cash collateral or marketable securities. So I think they really need to go back and sharpen their pencils and really figure out how we can work together. The obvious thing is the 7A program. You know, we need to figure out how all CDFIs, particularly the brightest and the best, and I think, we, as I said, we have a CARS rating system to figure that out so that they can get the program so we can get a lot more money out. I think, you know, CDFIs are part of the solution, and we do work well with the banks. And then finally, I would say that the bill in Congress, the small business lending, the $30 billion, CDFIs will have access to that money. It will be long-term capital at bond market rates. So I think that's going to be very helpful for us as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Sabeth?
From a regulatory supervisory perspective, I think one important area we need to continue to be vigilant and monitor is that to ensure that examiners are not impeding the availability of credit, and that's something we'll continue to do.
Great. Okay. Ginger, you have the last word.
We've talked about the need for quality data that in order to determine whether what's happened in the last 2 years is a blip or a seismic shift, and the only way we can really measure that is to get access to the type of consistent quality data, and I think that point has been driven home. I believe that the CDFI can be a very important mechanism for delivering additional financial products, but I think also one of the challenges there, if I can, you know, of the CDFIs that are currently licensed, 62 are banks, 179 are credit unions, 29 are depository institution holding companies, 567 are loan funds, and 25 of them are VCs. There is an I think there is a need in order to strengthen and ensure their participation in the broadest range of financial products that may be available through the government. There needs to be at some point some consistent level of oversight. I'm not talking about a huge regulatory burden because I think we all know that CDFIs operate on pretty thin margins. But right now there's no consistent level of oversight to help CDFIs raise their level of performance and improve their overall strength as organizations and lending institutions. So that's something I would put on the table as well.
Great. As I mentioned earlier in the day, myself or John Moon or Kyan Bishop will follow up with each and every one who didn't get a chance to publicly ask their questions so we can make sure we can register all the ideas that we get as we're putting together the final capstone document, and you can get our contact information from the registration table. With that, I'm going to say thank you to our panel, our final panel of the day. Thank you for joining me.